Abraham, a good neighbor in Canaan. This chapter is based on Genesis 13-15, 17:1-16, 18. Abraham returned to Canaan very rich in livestock, in silver and in gold. Lot was with him, and they came to Bethel and pitched their tents. Through hardships and trials, they had lived together in harmony, but in their prosperity, there was danger of conflict. There was not enough pasture for the flocks and herds of both, and it was evident that they must separate. Abraham was the first to propose plans for preserving peace. Although the whole land had been given to him by God himself, he courteously chose not to demand this right. "Let there be no strife," he said, "between you and me, and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brethren. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If you take the left, then I will go to the right, or if you go to the right, then I will go to the left." Many people under similar circumstances would cling to their individual rights and preferences. Many homes and many churches have been divided, making the cause of truth a scandal and a disgrace among the wicked. The children of God all over the world are one family, and the same spirit of love and peacemaking should govern them. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love, in honor giving preference to one another. Romans 12, verse 10. A willingness to do to others as we would wish them to do to us would prevent or end half the troubles of life. The heart in which the love of Christ is cherished will possess that unselfish love that does not seek its own. See also Philippians 2, verse 4. Lot did not show any gratitude to his generous uncle. Instead, he selfishly tried to grasp all the advantages. He lifted his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt. The most fertile region in all Palestine was the Jordan Valley, reminding its viewers of the lost paradise and equaling the beauty and productiveness of the Nile-enriched plains they had left. There were cities, wealthy and beautiful, inviting for profitable business. Dazzled with visions of worldly gain, Lot overlooked the moral evils found there. He chose for himself all the plain of Jordan and pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. Little did he foresee the terrible results of that selfish choice. Soon after this, Abraham moved to Hebron. Leaving to Lot the perilous luxury of Sodom, Abraham settled in the free air of those upland plains with their olive groves and vineyards, their fields of grain, and the wide pasture of the encircling hills, content with his simple life. Abraham did not shut away his influence from his neighbors. In contrast to the worshippers of idols, his life and character exerted a telling influence in favor of the true faith. His loyalty to God was unswerving, and his friendliness and kindness inspired confidence and friendship. While Christ is dwelling in the heart, it is impossible to conceal the light of his presence. It will grow brighter as the mists of selfishness and sin that envelop the soul are banished by the Sun of Righteousness. The people of God are lights in the moral darkness of this world. Scattered in towns, cities, and villages, they are channels through which God will communicate to an unbelieving world the knowledge and wonders of his grace. It is his plan that all who receive salvation will be lights that shine brightly in the character, revealing the contrast with the selfish darkness of the natural heart. Abraham was wise in diplomacy and brave and skillful in war. Three royal brothers, rulers of the Amorite plains in which he lived, showed friendship by inviting him to enter an alliance with them for greater security, because the country was filled with violence and oppression. An occasion soon arose for him to call on the help of this alliance. Lot rescued by Abraham. Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, had invaded Canaan years before and was ruling over it. Several of its princes now revolted, and the Elamite king again marched into the country to lower them into submission. Five kings of Canaan fought the invaders, only to be completely defeated. The victors plundered the cities of the plain and left with rich spoils and many captives, among whom were Lot and his family. Abraham learned the story of his nephew's calamity from someone who had escaped. All of his affection for Lot was awakened, and he determined to rescue him. Seeking divine counsel, Abraham prepared for war. He called up 318 trained servants from his own camp. These were men trained in the fear of God, in the service of their master, and in the practice of arms. His allies, Mamre, Eshcol, and Aner, joined him, and together they started after the invaders. The Elamites had encamped at Dan, on the northern border of Canaan. Proud and excited with victory, they had given themselves up to celebrating. Abraham came upon the encampment by night. His attack, so vigorous and unexpected, resulted in speedy victory. The king of Elam was killed, and his panic-stricken forces fled in defeat. Lot and his family, with all the prisoners and goods, were recovered, and the riches of the enemy fell into the hands of the victors. Abraham had not only performed a great service for the country, but had proved himself a strong and brave man. It was seen that Abraham's religion made him courageous in upholding the right and defending the oppressed. When Abraham returned, the king of Sodom came out to honor the conqueror, asking only that the prisoners be restored. The spoils belonged to the conquerors, but Abraham refused to take advantage of the unfortunate, only requiring that his allies receive the portion to which they were entitled. If given such a test, few would have resisted the temptation to keep such rich plunder. Abraham's example is a rebuke to self-seeking. "I have raised my hand," he said, "to the Lord God Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will take nothing, from a thread to a sandal strap, and that I will not take anything that is yours, lest you should say, 'I have made Abram rich.'" God had promised to bless Abraham, and the glory should go to him. Another who came out to welcome victorious Abraham was Melchizedek, king of Salem. As priest of God Most High, he pronounced a blessing on Abraham and gave thanks to the Lord, who had brought about deliverance by his servant. And Abraham gave him a tithe of all. Abraham is afraid. Abraham had been a man of peace, shunning strife as much as possible. With horror, he remembered the massacre he had witnessed. The nations whose forces he had defeated would certainly renew the invasion and take special revenge on him. Furthermore, he had not begun to take possession of Canaan, nor could he now hope for an heir to whom the promise might be fulfilled. In a vision of the night, God's voice was heard again. "Do not be afraid, Abram. I am your shield, your exceedingly great reward." But how was the covenant promise to be fulfilled while the gift of a son was withheld? "What will you give me," he said, "seeing I go childless? Indeed, one born in my house is my heir." He intended to make his trusty servant Eliezer his son by adoption, but he was assured that a child of his own was to be his heir. Then he was told to look up to the countless stars glittering in the heavens, and the words were spoken, "So shall your descendants be." Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. Romans 4, verse 3. The Lord stooped down to enter into a covenant with his servant. Abraham heard the voice of God, telling him not to expect immediate possession of the promised land, and pointing forward to the sufferings of his descendants before Canaan would be theirs. The plan of redemption was open to him in the death of Christ, the great sacrifice, and his coming in glory. Abraham also saw the earth restored to Eden beauty, given for an everlasting inheritance as the final and complete fulfillment of the promise. When Abraham had been in Canaan nearly 25 years, the Lord appeared to him and said, "Behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations." In pledge of the fulfillment of this covenant, his name Abram was changed to Abraham, father of a great multitude. Sarai's name became Sarah, princess, for she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples shall be from her. At this time, the rite of circumcision was given to Abraham, to be observed by him and his descendants as a sign that they were separated from idolaters and that God accepted them as his special treasure. They were not to marry the heathen, for by so doing, they would be tempted to engage in the sinful practices of other nations and be drawn into idolatry. Abraham unwittingly entertains angels. God conferred great honor on Abraham. Angels walked and talked with him. When judgments were about to come to Sodom, the fact was not hidden from him, and he became an intercessor with God for sinners. In the hot summer noontime, Abraham was sitting in his tent door when he saw three travelers in the distance. Before they reached his tent, the strangers stopped. Without waiting for them to ask any favors, with the utmost courtesy, Abraham urged them to honor him by staying for refreshment. With his own hands, he brought water that they might wash the dust of travel from their feet. He selected food, and while they were resting under the cooling shade, he stood respectfully beside them while they ate and drank what he provided. Years later, an inspired apostle referred to this act of courtesy. "Do not forget to entertain strangers, for by so doing, some have unwittingly entertained angels." Hebrews 13, verse 2. Abraham had seen in his guests only three tired travelers, not thinking that among them one was divine, whom he might worship without sin. But the true character of the heavenly messengers was now revealed. They were on their way as agents of wrath, yet to Abraham they spoke first of blessings. God does not take delight in vengeance. Abraham had honored God, and the Lord honored him, revealing to him his purposes. "Shall I hide from Abraham what I am doing?" said the Lord. "The outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grave, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that has come to me. And if not, I will know." God knew Sodom's guilt, but he expressed himself in human terms that his justice might be understood. He would go himself to conduct an examination of their course. If they had not passed the limits of divine mercy, he would give them an opportunity for repentance. Two of the heavenly messengers departed, leaving Abraham alone with the one whom he now knew to be the Son of God. And the man of faith pleaded for the inhabitants of Sodom. Once he had saved them by his sword, now he tried to save them by prayer. Lot and his household were still living there, and Abraham attempted to save them from the storm of divine judgment. With deep humility, he urged his plea. "I, who am but dust and ashes, have taken upon myself to speak to the Lord." He did not claim favor because of his obedience or the sacrifices he had made in doing God's will. As a sinner, he pleaded in the sinner's behalf. Yet Abraham showed the confidence of a child pleading with a loved father. Though Lot had chosen to live in Sodom, he did not join in the sins of its inhabitants. Abraham thought that there must be other worshippers of the true God in that large city, so he pleaded, "Far be it from you to slay the righteous with the wicked. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right?" As his requests were granted, he gained the assurance that if even 10 righteous persons could be found in Sodom, the city would be spared. Abraham's prayer for Sodom shows that we should cherish hatred of sin, but pity and love for the sinner. All around us, people are going down to ruin. Every hour, some are passing beyond the reach of mercy. Where are the voices of invitation, urging sinners to flee from this fearful doom? Where are those who are pleading with God for them? Who prays for Sodom today? The spirit of Abraham was the spirit of Christ, who is the great intercessor in the sinner's behalf. Christ extended a love toward the sinner that only infinite goodness could imagine. In the agonies of the crucifixion, burdened with the awful weight of the sins of the whole world, he prayed for his murderers. "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do." Luke 23, verse 34. The testimony of God is, "Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. I have known him, in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the Lord, to do righteousness and justice, that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him." It was a high honor to which Abraham was called, to be father of the people who were the guardians of the truth of God for the world, through whom all nations would be blessed in the coming of the Messiah. Abraham would keep the law and deal justly and righteously. In addition, he would not only fear the Lord himself, but would teach his family in doing right. Abraham's household numbered more than 1,000 people. Here, as in a school, they received instruction that would prepare them to represent the true faith. He was training heads of families, and they would follow his methods of government in their own households. It was necessary to unite the members of the household together, to build up a barrier against the widespread idolatry. Abraham worked to guard all those who were with him against mingling with the heathen and seeing their idol worship. He took care to impress the mind with the majesty and glory of the living God as the true object of worship. God himself had separated Abraham from his idolatrous relatives so that he might educate his family apart from the evil influences in Mesopotamia and preserve the true faith in its purity through his descendants. The influence of daily living. Abraham's children and household were taught that they were under the rule of the God of heaven. There was to be no oppression by the parents and no disobedience by the children. The silent influence of his daily life was a constant lesson. There was a fragrance about Abraham's life, a nobility of character, which revealed to everyone that he was connected with heaven. He did not neglect the humblest servant. His household did not have one law for the master and another for the servant. He treated everyone with justice and compassion as heirs with him of the grace of life. How few in our day follow this example. Too many parents are influenced more by emotion than reason, mistakenly calling it love when leaving children to the control of their own will. This is cruelty to the youth and a great wrong to the world. Their parents' laxness strengthens the desire of young people to follow their own wishes instead of submitting to God's requirements, and they grow up to transmit their unbelieving, rebellious spirit to their children and grandchildren. Obedience to parental authority should be taught as the first step in obedience to the authority of God. The widespread teaching that God's laws are no longer binding has the same effect on the morals of the people as idolatry. Parents do not require their families to keep the way of the Lord. Children, as they make homes of their own, feel no obligation to teach their children what they themselves have never been taught. This is why there are so many godless families and why wickedness is so widespread. A reformation is needed, deep and broad. Parents and ministers need to reform. They need God in their households. They must bring His Word into their families and teach their children kindly and untiringly how to live in order to please God. The children of such a household have a foundation that cannot be swept away by the incoming tide of doubt and godlessness. In many homes, parents feel they cannot spare a few moments to thank God for the sunshine and showers and for the protection of holy angels. They have no time for prayer. They go out to work like the ox or the horse, without one thought of God or heaven. The Son of God gave His life to ransom them, but they have little more appreciation of His goodness than animals do. If ever there was a time when every house should be a house of prayer, it is now. The father, as priest of the household, should offer to God a morning and evening sacrifice of prayer, while the wife and children unite with him in prayer and praise. Jesus will love to stay in such a home. From every home, love should flow out in thoughtful kindness, in gentle, unselfish courtesy. There are homes where God is worshipped and the truest love reigns. His mercies and blessings fall on these praying ones like morning dew. A well-ordered household is a powerful argument in favor of the Christian religion. A noble influence at work in the family affects the children. The God of Abraham is with them. God speaks to every faithful parent. I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord, to do justice and judgment. Chapter 5.